is the news.
Iran rejects Western media claims about sending drones to Russia, saying Tehran believes the Ukraine crisis should be settled through political means. The leader of the Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad says people of Palestine and its fighters will never surrender to Israel. Also coming up, Moscow denounces the Ukrainian president's call for NATO's preventive strikes against Russia, saying such statements are an appeal to start another world war. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has once again rejected allegations that it provided Russia with weapons for the ongoing war with Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran has not and will not provide any sort of arms to Russia to be used in the war. He made the remarks in a phone call with his Finnish counterpart, Pekka Haavisto. Emir Abdullahian said his country wants that Russia and Ukraine resolve their conflict through political means. He underlined that any kind of military aid to the warring sides would only delay the restoring of peace. The Ukrainian military has recently accused Russia of using Iranian-made drones in the Mykolaiv region. Kiev also announced downgrading diplomatic relations with Iran, citing a similar pretext. Tehran expressed regret over the decision and advised Ukraine to avoid being influenced by third parties seeking to destroy the two countries' relations. Iran accuses the West and its media empire of using human rights as a tool to exert pressure on other countries. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani was reacting to the recent anti-Iran sanctions by the Canadian government. Kanani noted that the world hasn't forgotten the historical crimes committed against the indigenous people in Canada. He also referred to the forced separation of over 150,000 indigenous children from their families and the recent discovery of mass graves of children in several Canadian provinces. He said talking about other countries does not change the history of rights violations by one of the closest allies of the US. Ottawa has imposed fresh sanctions on dozens of Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. It is not the first time Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it doesn't have any diplomatic relations. Iran's foreign minister has criticized the West for its double standards on human rights, especially with regard to women's rights. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Irish counterpart, Simon Coveney. Amir Abdullahian was reacting to interventionist remarks by some Western countries following recent riots in Iran over the death of a young woman after being taken by police. The top Iranian diplomat said Iranians have the constitutional right to hold peaceful protests. He, however, stressed that some rioters were directed from overseas and were incited by foreign media outlets. He said the rioters vandalized public property and attacked people and police with firearms and cold weapons. Amir Abdullahian noted that rioters will be brought to justice. The Iranian minister also highlighted the internet restrictions during the January 2021 protests which erupted over the US presidential election outcome. He said even the social media accounts of then American president were shut down. Iran has released a video of two French spies arrested some 4 months ago in which they've admitted to their efforts to incite chaos and unrest in the country. One of the spies has admitted to being an agent at the French Foreign Intelligence Agency, known as the General Directorate for External Security. She proceeds to explain how they brought in large sums of cash in order to fund riots and strikes, as well as purchase weaponry in an attempt to stir up chaos. She also states that their main aim was to lay the groundwork for mass unrest and trigger a revolution in Iran. The Iranian Ministry of Intelligence announced their arrest in May. The ministry stated that they had entered the country with the aim of hijacking peaceful rallies to create a social disorder. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier with his comments. He said Western countries are involved in espionage activities in Iran with the aim of regime change.
Well, firstly, I think it's a despicable reality that the Anglo-Zionist and French and other Western powers shamelessly have engaged in non-stop regime change espionage. Essentially, not only have they done it in terms of trying to undermine any nuclear, peaceful nuclear program Iran had, they've also done it to gather information on local people and to work on them in combination with cyber warfare. There's an entire cultural psychological operation that's been going on in a never-ending way. There are over 100 Iranian channels which are basically fronts for intelligence agencies outside. So there's been a combined attack, and it's no surprise to find these French spies who have been implicated and who have been caught, it seems, red-handed. Now, the thing is, it's not just the French. The British have been caught at it. The Americans have been caught at it big time.
The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on 7 Iranian officials. Washington accuses the targeted persons of, quote, supporting internet shutdown and suppressing peaceful protests. The U.S. Treasury Department says Iran's Interior Minister, Communications Minister, and the head of the Iranian Cyber Police are among those put on the sanctions list. Protests erupted in mid-September after a young woman died in hospital after being taken by police. They soon turned into violent riots, with some people vandalizing public property and attacking security forces with firearms and other weapons. Iran's first vice president says Iran and Russia can use their national currencies in bilateral commercial transactions, underlining that there are good capacities available between the two countries. Mohammad Mukhbir underscored the importance of replacing foreign currencies in Iran-Russia trade exchanges. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the second Caspian Economic Forum held in Moscow. In a meeting with governors and regional heads of the Russian Federation, he described the existing capacities as useful and constructive to boost bilateral relations. Mukhbir said both Tehran and Moscow are serious about expanding their economic ties to the maximum level.
The second Caspian Economic Forum has been held in Moscow. During the event, issues including developing trade and economic cooperation, interaction in the field of ecology, energy, transport and logistics were discussed. Delegations from the Caspian five literal states, namely Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran and Azerbaijan, were present at the event.
The countries of the Caspian region will have to work in the current turbulent conditions of the global economy and geostrategic tensions. The West is putting increasing pressure on other countries in an attempt to maintain the existing world order.
The Caspian region possesses a significant part of the world's gas and oil reserves. It is of high significance, especially at a time when the whole world is facing an unprecedented energy crisis. The Iranian authorities came up with a new proposal to address those issues.
In order to unify and harmonize tariffs for rail, road and sea transportation, expanding trade and economic cooperation, we propose to establish a committee for cooperation in the field of transport, transit and customs business.
The Islamic Republic, given its geographical location, has very good opportunities to conduct operations in the oil and gas sector, as well as providing energy supplies to other regions. Iran has stressed the need to accelerate the unification of the country's electric power networks with those of the Caspian states.
The main purpose of this forum is boosting the economy of regional countries and to enable the Caspian states to use their opportunities to develop trade and economic cooperation, culture and tourism. Also, everyone should not only use the opportunities of the Caspian Sea, but also protect it. We are actively working in the development of the North-South Transport Corridor. The shipping lines of the Islamic Republic of Iran have allocated 300 containers for the transportation of goods to Russia.
Apart from what was said and proposed at the event, the forum also had good news for the member states. Cruise shipping on the Caspian Sea is set to begin in 2023 for the first time in history.
More than 1,000 delegates from the five Caspian Sea littoral states, as well as Belarus, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, have taken part in the forum. In the meeting, the participants agreed to adopt decisions to enhance all-out cooperation among countries in the Caspian region. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A mass rally has been held in the besieged of the Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Jihad movement. The movement that refuses to recognize the Israeli regime while maintaining armed resistance as the only way to liberate Palestine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. People from all walks of life joined to show their support. The Islamic Jihad movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a uniting factor among them. The movement was founded by the late Dr. Fathi Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the teachings of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
Today we pay tribute to our founder Fathi Shaqaqi and all the martyrs. Our path is a very long one and paved by the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Al-Quds.
Ziad Al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, addressed the attendees via satellite link. During his speech, Al-Nakhala stressed the unity among all Palestinian factions and praised the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime.
Gaza is part of the axis of resistance, and this rally stresses that armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. People attending this event are affirming their allegiance to the resistance and to the Islamic Jihad movement.
The Islamic Jihad movement and its leaders remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime.
We are all here to support the resistance against the Zionist regime. Our people are sending a strong message to the whole world today about their unwavering support for the resistance. We will continue our struggle until the liberation of Al-Quds.
Islamic Jihad supporters want the Israeli regime to know that their movement is a force to be reckoned with.
35 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Russia has criticized the Ukrainian president for calling on the Western military alliance, NATO, to launch preventive strikes on Moscow. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said such statements are, quote, nothing other than an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable, monstrous consequences. The reaction came after Volodymyr Zelensky said he believed the strikes were necessary to prevent any use of nuclear weapons by Russia. Russia's foreign ministry has also accused Zelensky of trying to provoke a nuclear war. This as Moscow has time and again stated that it is not considering a nuclear strike on Ukraine. But Russia had warned that it will use any means necessary to protect its borders, people, and sovereignty. As Ukraine makes advances in the southern Kherson region and the north of Donbass, Johnny Miller reports from pro-Russian positions around Gorilovsky in the center of the Donetsk region.
The battered village of Golmovsky, the front line is only 100 meters away. There is a deadly tension here, as the streets are almost deserted.
And there are a few people on the streets here, picking up humanitarian supplies. I've tried to speak to some of them, but they just shake their head and say, I'd like to speak to you, but we just need to rush home because it's too dangerous here. There's shelling at any moment. They can be hit.
In some relative shelter, this man would speak to me.
Are you concerned about Ukrainian advances to the north of here?
No, I don't think they will come here. Everyone will rise up and won't let them. The people here have nowhere else to go. They couldn't beat us when there were only a few of us, and now Russia supports us.
And what do you think of the Ukrainians and the Ukrainian military?
They are not human. They know perfectly well where they shall. The square here is full of craters. Women were killed just over there while working. They know what they target.
It is mostly the elderly who remain in this town. They have nowhere else to go, and so are stranded in the middle of an artillery duel between the opposing armies. The boom of outgoing fire, a pro-Russian artillery piece, can't be far from the village. This man tells me he's 76 years old. He fears the coming winter, as his windows have been smashed by a blast. He also blames the Ukrainians for the war, and says they were sent here by the Americans and the Europeans. We head to the neighboring village of Zaitsevo. It was fully taken by pro-Russian forces a couple of weeks ago.
The front line's a couple of hundred meters away from here. It's understandably a ghost town at the moment. Very few civilians are here. Now, Barmut, a major settlement, isn't too far to the north of here. The Russians, or the pro-Russians, have been trying to take that settlement for months now. And just further to the north of that is Lyman, where the Ukrainian army has had some major successes in the last few days.
The situation is unstable. As you know, Zaitsevo is finally completely liberated. All its parts are now under our control. I think being here today, you'll hear that it's quite loud at the front lines. Artillery, both ours and the enemy's, are working. It's still early to relax.
Amongst the deadly tension of this village, the incongruous site of a rose garden, it houses a monument to civilians killed by Ukrainian shelling. It was built 18 months before the Russians sent their army across the border in February. A reminder that Ukraine has been bombing pro-Russian areas here for 8 years.
I lived and worked here in the village and saw what's going on. I can tell you there is nobody here, including me, who would agree to any compromise. We have suffered so much during this time that hardly anything can make peace between us.
With peace talks unlikely anytime soon, frontline positions are fluctuating across hundreds of kilometers of Ukraine. Both sides will want to gain as much territory as possible before the winter comes, making advances more difficult. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom government, which supported the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel decades ago, is now moving further toward the Zionist regime and its sinister goals. There are reports that new British Prime Minister Liz Truss has already promised Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid that she will review whether to move the UK's embassy to Al-Quds. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the third part, please. The fact that the British government believes it can pursue both deals at the same time also shows how The so-called Abraham Accords have shifted perceptions of what Britain can get away with in the region and the waning powers of the so-called Arabist at the Foreign Office. Indeed, during her leadership campaign, Truss tapped into the current British penchant for exploiting the struggle against anti-Jewish bigotry for political gain by accusing civil servants of anti-Semitism. Also warming every zealous pro-Zionist heart is a domestic agenda that includes an effort to ban local councils from pursuing their own boycott and divestment campaigns. The ban will primarily shield the fabricated regime of Israel from a growing boycott movement in the UK. A Truss government, therefore, looks set to shift UK policy away from its decades-old lip service to international law and into territory currently occupied only by the hikes and the likes of the US and Micronesia. British Daily Guardian reported the UK's position at the time was not out of altruistic humanitarianism, but as a reflection of its national interest, and it should maintain that awareness instead of doing an about-face in the worst possible fashion. To move the embassy to Al-Quds would be to recognize the Zionist regime's invasion and occupation of East Al-Quds as legitimate. Palestinians would quite rightly see this as a rejection of Britain's long-standing endorsement of the two-state solution, which they have always insisted includes a capital in East Al-Quds. It would be a final nail in the coffin of a policy that London has held for decades and which has allowed Britain to maintain good relations with both the Israelis and Palestinians. Guardian added, to recognize the invasion and occupation as legitimate would also come at a time when the UK is rightly aiding and assisting Ukraine in its struggle. How would London's credibility be taken seriously on Ukraine if it accepted an occupation in Al-Quds? It's not clear what the reasoning is. London already has excellent connections with the Zionist regime, so this isn't about repairing a broken relationship. Indeed, the Israelis themselves were not expecting this. In the occupied territories itself, there are numerous human rights defenders who are set against the move. They know that the Israeli regime already stands accused of perpetrating an apartheid regime system in the occupied territories that belongs to Palestinians, and that to avoid it becoming a permanent reality, a two-state solution is the only option that has widespread backing, a solution that would be dismembered with a move of the embassy. Britain's Arab allies in unison have expressed their full rejection of the idea. Even Arab states that have formal and full diplomatic relations with the fabricated regime of Israel have been clear that such a move would be out of bounds. A collective letter from Arab ambassadors in London has already been delivered to the Foreign Office, which says such a deal could jeopardize a free trade deal with the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council. Beyond Britain's Arab allies, it has a much wider set of relationships with the Commonwealth and Muslim-majority states worldwide. In much of the former, and certainly all of the latter, Al-Quds, as the place of the third holiest site in Islam, the Haram al-Sharif, or the Dome of the Rock, and Al-Aqsa Mosque, is incredibly important. This includes a large number of Britain's most crucial trading partners worldwide, with whom it will be no doubt trying to deepen and widen relations. Does Britain really want to endanger these relationships in exchange for nothing in return? Perhaps the Prime Minister is simply trying to create a new and bold impression with these kinds of moves. But such an impression will come at a great cost to British interest and bring no benefits at all. On a cross-party basis, Britons urgently need a unified course correction before irrevocable damage is done.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody. Today, on the 9th of Rabiul Awwal, the first day of the start of the mission of the Lord of the Age, the Prophet's 12th and last infallible successor, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, following the martyrdom of his father, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, the day before, here is a saying from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, regarding the awaited Savior of mankind, who is presently in occultation by the will of God, and will reappear in the end times to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. The earth shall never be devoid of the divine proof. He may be apparent and prominent, or he may be concealed and hidden. And it is because of him that the proofs and signs of Allah are not wasted.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, faithfulness towards a friend. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone, you're listening to A to Z program, and I'm your host Hussein Hinzano. Now in today's lesson, we want to talk about the faithfulness towards a friend. A friend is he who becomes faithful to his friends, both at the time of happiness and at the time of difficulties, or even at the time of prosperity and adversity. There are some friends whose relationship deceives you, and thereby he feels happy when he gets something from you, but you feel that he is your faithful friend and your lover. He continues this relationship with you and greets you with a smile whenever he meets you. But once he feels that you are in difficulty or that you are in need of his help and support, then he will change his behavior towards you, you know, and it's as if there is no love and friendship between you at all. These kinds of friends are not your real and faithful friends. One of the main aspects and better principles of friendship, and something that can build your friendship to be successful, is you having faithfulness towards each other. Many people have had uncountable friends when they had wealth or when they were holding a high social position maybe in life. But they, or the friends, all dispersed from them when they lost their wealth or their position. You have many friends because you have the money, you have the position, high rank in life. They're coming to you. You lose that rank, you lose the money, the friends are going away. This shows how faithfulness is important to friendship, because these particular friends who are running away from you whenever you're not in good shape, you're not in good position of life, these aren't faithful friends. So one of the aspects that we're talking here, we need to practice in life. We need to practice during our friendship relationships is being faithful to each other.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. We're talking about the faithfulness towards a friend and how important it is in friendship. Indeed, the history has narrated to us some examples of faithfulness and brotherhood. It was narrated that Masruq and Haythama were among the first generation of Muslims. They had a heavy amount of credit on their neck. Each one of them knew about the credit of his brother. Then Masruq started to pay the debt of Haythama without his knowledge. And likewise, Haythama started to pay the debt of Masruq without his knowledge. This story shows faithfulness and sincere friendship, you know, as well as the act of supporting others at the time of difficulties. This is how friendship should be. Help someone, even if they don't know. You don't need to let them know that you're helping them. Because you love them, it doesn't have to be known. So indeed, faithfulness is not only towards your friend. Rather, you should also show it to his friends, children, to his relations. Don't just like your friend and say that his son or his wife or his daughter. You can help them whenever you have the chance to. And it doesn't have to be known. So faithfulness is one of the main aspects that we need to look at whenever we want to build a good relationship between us. So being faithful towards your friends is one of the best acts you could do. And it definitely brings about good relationship, good success within the life of the people that we're living together. It brings a lot of success in your relationship. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, Scientific News, Artistic News, With Delight.
On the outskirts of China's metropolis, Shanghai, a tiny island has been dubbed Cat Island as it provides shelter for stray animals. Since it opened last month, a charity based on the island is taking in cats, mainly brought from Shanghai residents. These small carnivorous mammals are neutered and evaluated, and those with good temper and health are allowed to roam free on the island. The city's Stray Cats Management Center says their trap-neuter-release policy is to protect stray cats, limits their population, and maintain ecological balance. However, Shanghai has an estimated 200 stray cats per square kilometer, which means other methods will be needed to control the urban population, stray cats. A pair of baby panda twins make their debut appearance at the Chongqing Zoo in southwest China, with visitors flocking to cherish the abundance of cuteness.
Our returnee panda, Ershan, gave birth to the twin brother and sister on July 22nd this year. Currently, the elder brother weighs 4.3 grams and the younger sister weighs 0.6 grams. They're in good condition at present.
The twins' first public appearance was on Saturday, the first day of the week-long National Day holidays. During this week, the pair of giant panda cubs will be on display in the nursery of the panda house of the zoo. Their mother, Ershan, once lived in Canada as a goodwill envoy, but returned to her homeland in 2020. This was Ershan's second delivery of twins. A total of 21 pandas currently live in the Chongqing Zoo, which has been breeding giant pandas since the 1960s. The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. An aircraft powered by electricity may still be some way off, but one of its types is already here thanks to a whole range of innovative solutions being developed by aviation firms. American company Aviation Aircraft has debuted its all-electric plane in Washington State. The aircraft, named Alice, took off the runway at Grand County International Airport and flew for 8 minutes. It reached an altitude of 3,500 feet before touching down the ground. According to the company, the aircraft produces no carbon emissions, significantly reduces noise, and costs a fraction to operate compared to usual light jets. The company says it continues to develop and tweak the plane's battery system for an hour flight.
We're targeting a design criteria of 35 minutes for a charge. And so that'll be a charge for the typical route length. It's actually, as I just said, it's actually a design point. So going back to the comment I made earlier about designing batteries for aircraft, it's one of the considerations is how quickly do we want it to charge? How much power do you want to be able to draw from it? So again, we're targeting call it 30 minutes of charge for an hour of flight time, or about 2C if you're...
The company aims to find its way into the market for trips that sit between 150 and 250 miles, a range that features aircraft similar in size to Alice. It will also be for both commuter and cargo flights. For aircraft manufacturers, this paradigm shift is driving fuel savings in flight and on the ground, reducing carbon footprints and NOx emissions, while also improving reliability and cutting maintenance costs. Many people of the world are supported almost completely by animals because they live in areas unsuitable for animal husbandry. But these days, even some city dwellers are making their living out of animals, like a Virginia girl. Andrea Diaz quit her job at a restaurant and started to rent her pet alpacas to cheer up steer crazy Americans during the pandemic. Since the launch of her business in 2020, it has expanded from 2 to 14 alpacas. Interestingly, five with fluffy pets are regularly making a paid appearance at birthdays, weddings, restaurants, and offices. She charges a starting price of $95 per hour. Diaz says the best part is when there are kids' birthday parties, but even it's really a fun for the adults. She calls alpacas a good exposure because they attract people.
In most of its habitats, the heavily trafficked pangolin faces the biggest threat from humans. But in Taiwan, these gentle creatures are exposed to quite a different danger, feral dogs. In the island, a government policy has led to a surge in the population of feral dogs. The pangolins share most of their roaming area with the stray animals. Plus, these scaly animals cannot move as fast as their attackers. When faced with danger, pangolins curl themselves into a ball shape, but the tail still remains at the most outer side, and that's where the dogs hit them hard.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Ecuador's Galapagos National Park is testing different coral replanting methods in an effort to restore fragile underwater ecosystems around local islands.
These corals are important because they are recyclers in the ocean. They convert all the CO2 into oxygen. These corals are important because they are refuges, nurseries, and nursery areas for some fish species.
Coral reef die-offs affect the marine food supply chains and are considered a major climate tipping point. The experimental project is run by park rangers and volunteers in a bay on Santa Cruz Island. Since 2020, they have tested how corals reproduce when they are placed on surfaces like bricks, cement, or tied together and strung on metal frames. They are growing samples in a nursery before adding them to bay. The rangers are reporting improvements with the appearance of new fish near the replanted corals.
A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good nod.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports. A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out 3 patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC. They're back as India has revealed or released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The 8 radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India, covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths, and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. World Cleanup Day unites millions of volunteers, governments and organizations to tackle the global waste problem and build a sustainable world. People in several countries joined the efforts again for a waste-free world. Volunteers were seen in mangrove forests in the suburb of Bangkok. They collected more than 1.5 tons of rubbish in just a few hours. Trash picking events were also held in the Philippines and Vietnam. In Hanoi, hundreds, mostly students armed with metal tongs and sacks, walked along major roads. They said their aim is to raise awareness about protecting the environment. In Manila, people cleaned up the city's beaches that are major tourist attractions. The annual cleanup day has been running for over a decade. From divers collecting marine debris to children picking up trash on beaches have just one goal: make our planet a cleaner place.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon on the 15th day of the 8th month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists fear what could come next once monkeypox spreads in wild animals. And here's why you should be worried too. After the first case of human-to-dog transmission was reported in August, many got anxious on how this could become more common as the outbreak continues. Please stay with us for an article in this regard published recently in Nature. Stephanie Seifert felt a surge of anxiety when she learned about the first dog known to catch monkeypox from a human. She says, "I have dogs, so I was like, well, that's awful." But Seifert, a viral ecologist at Washington State University in Pullman, who studies how viruses jump between species, also understood the potential significance of the case. In the month since the surge of global monkeypox cases, which started in May, she and her colleagues waited to hear reports of animal catching the virus from people. The first case of human-to-dog transmission was reported in August. The Italian greyhound in France had slept in the same bed with a couple who had symptoms. Viral DNA from the dog matched that from one of the owners. The same month, Brazil's health ministry announced the case of a puppy catching the virus from a person. The problem is not odd case of human-to-dog transmission, says Malaki Okek, a virologist at the American University of Nigeria in Yola. Sick pets can be isolated at home. Scientists are more worried about a scenario in which the monkeypox virus becomes established in wild animals such as the rodents outside its usual range in West and Central Africa. Such animal reservoirs could then transmit the virus back to people. Okay, said, then we are in trouble. Controlling the spread in wild animal populations could be extremely difficult, he explains, making the virus impossible to eliminate. Monkeypox is known to infect more than 50 species of mammal, according to data compiled by researchers at the University of Liverpool, UK. But scientists don't know the virus's exact reservoir, the animal or animals that continuously carry and spread the virus without becoming ill from it. The evidence so far indicates that rodents and other mammals in Africa, including Gambian pouched rats, tree squirrels, rope squirrels, and target rats, are responsible for keeping the virus circulating in the wild there. Monkeypox outbreaks in people have been cropping up in parts of Africa for decades. Many more people have been infected in the past few months than in previous outbreaks, thereby increasing the chances of the virus interacting with animals. Data from the World Health Organization indicate that the number of weekly reported cases reached a peak of nearly 7,500 in August. More than 3,400 new cases were confirmed last week. If the virus did establish itself in a rodent population outside Africa, that could mean trouble, according to a modeling study published on September 11th. The model, which mimics how monkeypox spreads, forecast an outbreak in a hypothetical metropolitan area when the model factored in the existence of a mouse reservoir. It predicted that animal transmission would drive much earlier peaks and multiple waves. When human-to-animal and animal-to-human spread is factored into the transmission process, things become much more complicated, says disease modeler Hugh Pingzhu, director of the Canadian Center for Disease Modeling at York University in Toronto and the study's lead author. Without an understanding of how animals change transmission dynamics, scientists will struggle to control the virus's spread and prevent future outbreak, she says. Part of the reason scientists don't know the virus's reservoir is a lack of active long-term surveillance for monkeypox in the wild, says Oke, but there is also the lack of interest because this virus is endemic to the so-called resource-poor countries. People didn't take it seriously, he adds. I feel ashamed to say this, but that's the reality. With few data from the field to indicate how animals might affect the course of the current outbreak, some scientists are taking other approaches. For instance, predicting which species might be more susceptible to infection than others would help officials to know where to increase surveillance, says virologist Marcus Balgrove at the University of Liverpool. Balgrove and his colleagues gathered massive amounts of data, including the generic structure of monkeypox and of 62 other pox viruses, and characteristics of nearly 1,500 mammals, including their diet, habitat, and daily activities. They then trained machine learning algorithms to analyze the information and locate potential monkeypox hosts. Their results, which were posted to the BioRevix preprint server on August 15th and have not been peer-reviewed, suggest that 2 to 4 times more animal species might be susceptible to infection with the virus than are currently known to be, mostly rodents and primates. There are a lot of potential hosts all over the world, including in Africa, but also in regions such as Europe and North America. Whether these creatures could become reservoirs and shed the virus is hard to predict. Scientists lack important data, such as information about the potential host's immune response and direct evidence of the virus passing from those animals to another species, which would suggest that the host is a reservoir, Seifert says. The best way to prevent the monkeypox virus from spilling over into more animals and possibly establishing a reservoir outside Africa, Seifert adds, is to stop the spread between humans. And the best way to do that is to ramp up vaccine distribution. That's how we reduce the likelihood of these rare events from happening, is we protect people.
Why Syria? part two.
Nine years is not a short period. It's similar to the period of a child who was born and is now a couple of years into school, or a teenager who is now admitted to university, or a student who has graduated, is married, and is now likely expecting his first child.